10 years in prison is the maximum sentence for making threats to kill, indecent assault and burglary with intent to commit rape. It's now also the maximum sentence for lying on a passenger location form. This is the policy announced by Matt Hancock yesterday. We think it's probably to make up for having actually quite a weak policy on travel restrictions. He's come out with something which is incredibly authoritarian and I imagine very unlikely to ever be used. I can't imagine anyone going away for 10 years. But anyway, it's a sign of the tactics this government are comfortable using. They don't want to pay sick pay. They don't want to have proper quarantine, but they will put you away for 10 years. I'll be discussing this new policy with Aaron Bastani. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing very well, Michael. How are you keeping?
I haven't left the front door in like 3 days, which is a little bit worrying. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow. On Tuesday, Matt Hancock announced new travel restrictions to come into force next Monday to keep new variants of COVID-19 out of the UK. Hancock announced that arrivals from countries on the red list, which currently includes South America and Southern Africa, would have to stay for 10 days in hotel quarantine at a cost to the traveller of £1,750. Arrivals from the rest of the world will not be subject to hotel quarantine, but will be legally obliged to take a COVID test on day 2 and day 8 after their arrival. Those tests will be genomically sequenced so that we know what new variants we might be letting in. We'll find out a little bit too late, but it's better than nothing. Now, the rules themselves had been trailed for a while. There were a few surprises. However, it was the punishments for non-compliance that sparked political controversy.
Passenger carriers will have a duty in law to make sure that passengers have signed up for these new arrangements before they travel and will be fined if they don't. And we'll be putting in place tough fines for people who don't comply. This includes a £1,000 penalty for any international arrival who fails to take a mandatory test, a £2,000 penalty to any international arrival who fails to take the second mandatory test, as well as automatically extending their quarantine period to 14 days, and a £5,000 fixed penalty notice, rising to £10,000 for arrivals who fail to quarantine in a designated hotel. We're also coming down hard on people who provide false information on the passenger locator form. Anyone who lies on the passenger locator form and tries to conceal that they've been in a country on the red list in the 10 days before arrival here will face a prison sentence of up to 10 years.
So lots of fines there, but it was that 10-year prison sentence which really raised eyebrows. Now, the situation or the circumstance in which you could find yourself with that 10-year prison sentence is if you travel to somewhere or you arrive from somewhere, from which is a red list country. So, for example, imagine you're in Brazil, you're trying to get back to Britain, but you don't want to do the hotel quarantine. You go via Miami, and then the British authorities, you tell them, oh, no, I've been in Miami the whole time. So if you lie on that form and say, no, I haven't been in a red list country when in fact you have, then according to Matt Hancock, you could end up in prison for 10 years. We're going to talk about sort of the policy announcement in more detail. First of all, Aaron, I want your take specifically on that threat of 10 years in prison for lying on a passenger locator form.
In terms of this measure, yeah, clearly it's just performative authoritarianism to cover for ultimately a huge failure, a historic failure of policy and governance when it comes to public health measures. There was polling out, I think, end of last week, beginning of this week, 2 days ago, so the beginning of this week, showing that even amongst Labour supporters, 84% of Labour supporters think the government's doing a good job on vaccinations. That's entirely fair. I think it's also entirely fair to say they've done a decent job on economic stimulus. I mean, my God, they should be, given we're running a 20% deficit, the highest of any major economy. Where they've completely failed is actually keeping people safe, keeping various mutations out of the country, keeping the R rate down. And this is to make up for that. And you know what? It may well work, Michael, because this is the exact game the Tories have been playing for the last 10 years. And as we've seen, each general election, they get a higher share of the vote. So I think it's entirely plausible on their side that this gestural, performative authoritarianism makes up for very real shortcomings when it comes to policy.
I imagine you're right that they won't be punished, for example, for putting forward this very authoritarian policy. The Tories aren't normally punished for that kind of thing. But I think there are many people who are seeing through what is quite a transparent ruse. I think this was a text from a Tory MP to Alex Wickham. It was in the Politico email this morning. So the Tory MP writes, "We've been stuck on a borders policy that is too weak, and now Hancock has shit the bed and come up with this empty threat to overcompensate. Now, that has been, I think you're hearing actually lots of Tory backbenchers speak along those lines. It's also quite possible that Matt Hancock didn't really want to announce this policy. This seems to be a bit of a messy compromise between the Prime Minister and Matt Hancock. Matt Hancock wanted to have a blanket quarantine policy, which would apply to all countries because, I mean, you can fault the guy, but he does seem to understand that you can't keep variants out by just restricting travel from places where you already know they are. You actually do need a blanket policy. But sort of to come out and it not look like the government are being weak, he's had to announce this quite embarrassing policy to say that if you lie on this form, you get a similar punishment to if you've, as I said in the introduction, committed burglary with intent to rape. This is a real sentence for hard criminals. The Labour Party are backing blanket hotel quarantine, just like Matt Hancock is in private. And it is one of the issues they are making really loud noises about. They've got lots of policies you don't really notice. This is one they are consistently pushing. Let's look at the relevant exchange from today's Prime Minister's questions.
Another area where the Prime has repeatedly delayed and now changes policy pretty well every day is securing our borders against variants of COVID. Every week the Prime Minister comes here and says we've got one of the toughest regimes in the world. We know his Home Secretary disagrees with him. We know the Health Secretary disagrees with him. Luckily, Mr. Speaker, Oxford University keep track of how tough border restrictions are in every country. They say that there are at least 33 countries around the world which currently have tougher restrictions for the United Kingdom. 33, Prime Minister, including Canada, Denmark, Japan, Israel. There are many others. In fact, they say we're not even in the top bracket of countries for border restrictions. 50 days after we first discovered the South African variant, 50 days. How does the Prime Minister explain that?
Mr. Speaker, there are some countries in Europe that do not even have a hotel quarantine scheme, such as the one we're putting in on Monday. We have amongst the toughest border regimes anywhere in the world. And people should understand that on a normal day, Mr. Speaker, at this time of year, you could expect about 250,000 people to be arriving in this country. We've got it down to about 20,000, 5,000 of whom are involved in bringing vital things into this country, such as medicines and food, as we discussed last week, and he agreed that was a good idea, Mr. Speaker. Unless he actually wants to cut this country off from the rest of the world, which I think last week he said he didn't want to do, unless, of course, he changed his mind again, Mr. Speaker, I think that this policy is measured, it is proportionate, it is getting tougher from Monday. I hope that he supports it.
Now, any regular viewer of this show will know that Britain doesn't have one of the toughest travel policies in the world. We only required a negative test from the 15th of January. So while he's saying hotel quarantine isn't in place in lots of Europe, it is in France. It isn't everywhere, though. He's correct on that. On most counts, we were really, really far behind everyone else. We were an outlier in terms of how relaxed we were about international travel into this country. It's also worth noting that whilst he loves to compare Britain to countries who are even more relaxed than ourselves, it's not a surprise, at this point in time, which countries are succeeding and which countries aren't. So Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Vietnam, they have all restricted incoming travel. And that's the reason why they have such low COVID cases and low deaths. So I'm not sure why we wouldn't be comparing ourselves to those successful countries instead of excusing inaction because other people are even worse. Now, unfortunately for Boris Johnson, on the day he was, or in the week, sorry, he's trying to argue that Britain actually has a very tough system when it comes to incoming travel, a journalist arrived in Britain from South Africa. So South Africa, obviously, we hear all the time about the South Africa variant, the variant which is somewhat resistant to the vaccine. We don't know how significant this will be when it comes to severe disease, but when it comes to moderate disease, the AstraZeneca vaccine isn't very good against that South Africa variant. So this should be the type of incoming travel we're particularly worried about. However, this journalist, Sharon Feinstein, said she had very few checks at all. She described on Tuesday to the BBC her experience of arriving at Heathrow.
Full of documents. I had my passenger locator form. I had my test, my negative COVID test. I had various other things, proof as to why I had traveled in the first place, which is in November. And I was through in 10 minutes, as you said. No one was there. No one was checking me. You know, it was very distressing, to be honest. I wasn't triumphant about it. I looked around. People were waving people in this direction, that direction. And then I did the electronic passports, and I was through. I was in the arrivals hall within 10 minutes. I'd expected to be an hour, as I was when I arrived in South Africa, because they did check everything. So I was shocked. And I, as I say, I wasn't triumphant. I was very saddened because of what we're going through, because of how desperate our situation is. I mean, we're the fourth highest death rate in the world. Let's get a grip. Yeah. We're doing all this. We're spending all this money to go around testing people who may have the South African strain. And I could be incubating it. How do we know how many people are infected at the airport? Not only that, I was on that little passenger train from where I got off to the customs, and we were crammed together like sardines. There was no one to enforce social distancing. You know, I thought, if I'm going to get the virus anywhere, it's going to be at Heathrow.
Now, there were a number of things that were really worrying about what that journalist said there. I mean, obviously, she said in that interview that she will be self-isolating for 10 days. So even though there weren't any checks, it seems like she's going to do the responsible thing, or at least that's what she's telling the BBC. Obviously, if you're someone who, you know, doesn't really, you know, you're not keen to self-isolate, you probably need a bit of nudging to do it. Then the fact that you can go straight through Heathrow with no checks or anything, that's not a very good sign. Most worrying, though, I think, is that even if you are someone who wants to do the right thing, so Sharon Feinstein was the person speaking there, she sounds like she does. She's saying to get to her house before she could self-isolate, she has to go through a very busy airport. She has to go on a packed, you know, those trains that go between the runway and the airport. And that, to me, sounds like a potential super spreader event coming from a country where the dominant strain of COVID-19 is specifically the strain we don't want to come into this country or to become dominant into this country, because it could completely disrupt our vaccination program. I thought Keir Starmer on that point was actually fairly effective in PMQs, and Boris Johnson's line that actually we have a very tough system. I don't think anyone's believing it at this point, are they?
No, and I think the specifics really matter here, Michael. So let's go to Vietnam. And I think Vietnam is a really useful country to point to. You can point to Singapore, you can point to Taiwan, but Vietnam is a very poor country. It's a very large country, and it has a huge land border with China. So, you know, you're looking at a country that's poorer than Bulgaria, for instance. Singapore is one of the wealthiest countries in the world per head. But Vietnam had about 35 deaths, I believe, so far. It blocked all travel from China, inbound travel from China, on the 1st of February. On the 1st of February last year, it blocked all incoming travel on the 22nd of March. Michael, when did we close nightclubs and bars and restaurants in this country last year?
Was it the 23rd of March?
It was the 20th. And that was how we were behaving. By then, already, you've had all incoming passengers from China. More than a month and a half, that's happened. And about the same time, in fact, the same day that Boris Johnson goes to hospital, Vietnam says, you know what, we're not going to have any new people entering the country. They'd already closed all schools. And that's why they've only had 35 deaths. It's not because they're fixing the numbers. It's not because they have, they've thrown huge amounts of money at this. They've got very effective test and trace. But the two key interventions they made, incredibly low cost. I mean, clearly they're going to have massive consequences for the economy, people's mental health, as they do here right now. But closing schools and closing borders. And they did it early. They did it decisively. And it worked. And I think just holding those comparisons up, like you say, we are literally a year behind. We're a year behind Vietnam, and we're still not doing things as well as they are. But when you look at quarantine hotels, when you talk about a relatively informed conversation about, you know, how this might work through borders, a relatively informed conversation when it comes to school closures and so on, we're a year behind Vietnam. That's not to denigrate Vietnam. It's an incredibly impressive country given everything it's faced over the last 80, 90 years, but it's not a very wealthy country. And I think it's really incumbent on us as people in the United Kingdom to say our political class, our media class has been utterly second rate compared to a country which, like I say, is poorer than Bulgaria, Romania on a per head basis. And I think that really does give food for thought to people who believe in British exceptionalism. You know, we have been completely, massively outperformed by a very, very poor country. A country which, let's be real, most Brits would look down on And they would say, you know, they're nothing compared to Great Britain. Britannia rules the waves. Look at the facts. Look at the data. Hugely impressive response by Vietnam. And it highlights how appalling and abject ours has been.
And this is a lesser point. We shouldn't say the problem here is people on left Twitter. This policy was made by the government and they're the only people who should be blamed for it. But I do find it quite frustrating when I see people on the left who say sort of like, how dare you back a policy of restricting travel severely during a pandemic? That's not the real issue. The real issue is we need a well-functioning test and trace system. Now, we do need a well-functioning test and trace system. We do need to support people so that they can self-isolate if they get contacted by that test and trace system. It's outrageous we don't have those things. But at the same time, the countries which have been successful at limiting outbreaks of COVID-19, they have all had severe travel restrictions. I don't think the sort of principles that people stick to in normal times don't necessarily apply in a pandemic. And the thing I think that's really important here that I don't think is quite cut through to everyone is that closing your borders, or you know, to most people in a pandemic, is not a beggar thy neighbor policy. It's not saying, look, screw you, we're going it alone. It's actually the opposite. Because if you close your borders during a pandemic, and I'm saying specifically this is during a pandemic, you're not only stopping new variants and new cases coming into your country, you're stopping new variants and new cases leaving your country. And I mean, Britain has been quite a hotbed for new variants. So the fact that we've had lots of international travel going through Britain, it hasn't been very good for us. It probably hasn't been very good for everyone else. There are lots of countries who are now having spikes because of the variant, which we think originated in Kent. So to lock off travel benefits everyone. And it's not a coincidence that we're not worried about the New Zealand variant or the Australia variant or the Japanese variant or the Vietnamese variant. We're not worried about those because those countries have taken responsible actions, which, yes, have included basically shutting their borders to most travelers. And that doesn't just benefit them, it benefits us all. So I do think most of the arguments against having very strict travel restrictions are very, very weak in this case. Aaron, do you want to comment on that? I mean, I don't know if you've seen sort of a similar level of sort of people saying like, for example, when this 10-year prison sentence or threat of 10-year prison sentences, I'm sure it's never going to happen. People say, oh, this is what you asked for when you encouraged stricter travel measures. I mean, to me, I don't find it very convincing. I don't know what you make of it. Is there something I'm missing? Should we at least be worried about the rhetoric that we used when we call for these policies?
Well, I think, you know, Labour had that advertising campaign, which highlighted the issue of needing to close the borders. And I think it was couched in a way which wasn't particularly useful. I mean, I agree with the intervention as a policy intervention. You need to articulate why, but it needs to be couched within a broader public health kind of argument. You can't just say, close the borders and not say why. And I think, you know, that needs to be made clear. This is a very cheap, very effective way of dealing with this virus, which the government hasn't done, and just explain it for what it is. What I also want to say, Michael, is because over the last year, we've heard an argument about this is, you know, the economy versus public health. And actually, if you look at, and foremost within that, Britain's so globalized, so connected, so networked, we have to keep, you know, air travel coming over because, of course, it's good for the economy. But let's go back again to China, Vietnam, Taiwan. These are countries which have closed their borders very quick, decisively last year, by the way. And if we look at their economic growth, people might respond, say, well, GDP doesn't matter. It's not good. You care about climate change way too much GDP. But we're just talking about the terms of the conversation we've seen from our domestic politicians, the economy versus public safety. Guess which economies have seen GDP growth this year of around 3%? Vietnam, Taiwan, and China. And we've seen huge economic contraction in Britain and the rest of the European Union, less so in the United States. So again, it just belies, you know, the common sense that's being peddled by the government, the economy versus public health, oh, solutions will cost so much. Oh, you know, everybody's struggling here. All of this is factually incorrect. And this is not about getting a gotcha on the government. This matters because A, we want to get out of this as quickly as possible, but B, Britain has to learn from this for the next pandemic that comes along. The reason why the East Asians and Australia and New Zealand are doing such a great job now is because they learned the lessons after SARS in 2003. What worries me the most is that this kind of bellicose British exceptionalism manifests itself in not actually learning the lessons. You know, what are the big policy takeaways the Tories are going to take going forward from this? Oh, well, we're going to have a law and order approach next time there's a pandemic. That's not going to help us. It's not going to keep us safe. It's just their safe and happy place when it comes to trying to appeal to their electoral base.
Restricting travel without a broader strategy is pretty pointless. The broader strategy is what matters, and I think restricting travel has to be part of that. But obviously what's key here is the issue of variants. So in Britain, in Kent, the Kent variant was more transmissible. That was what was so worrying about it. That's why it spread so fast. That was called the N501Y. That was the feature that it had. It's called the N501Y mutation, which makes viruses more transmissible. What we're really worried about now is a different mutation called E484K. And this is the one that gives the virus some degree of vaccine resistance, not necessarily total vaccine resistance, but some degree of vaccine resistance. That's what the South African variant has. Also the variant in Brazil, which is why we're currently restricting travel from those particular countries. We did get some worrying news this week, though, because it seems that the vaccine-resistant variant is evolving or mutating independently in this country. Again, I say vaccine resistant. It's not completely vaccine resistant, but it's more resistant to the vaccine than the original viruses that we have. So this mutation, the E484K mutation, emerged in Bristol this week, or at least was identified in Bristol this week. Patrick Vallance was asked about this today.
The Bristol variant has got one of the changes that the South African variants got as well. And again, it's one that the virus likes to try and get. So it's not surprising it's happened, and it will happen elsewhere as well. And in getting that variant, it does make it slightly more likely to look different to the immune system. So we need to watch out for it. We need to measure it. We need to keep on top of it and need to keep testing the vaccine effects in this situation. But the very key thing, the thing that we have to do, is get numbers down. The lower you get numbers, the lower the chance of getting more mutations.
Thank you. Tom Clark, ITV News.
Oh, I didn't answer the question.
We didn't actually need to leave the last 2 seconds of that clip, but we decided to because what you saw was Laura Koonsberg leaving her microphone on saying, oh, you didn't answer the question. That wasn't about Patrick Vallance. Actually, he answered his question very well. It was that Laura Koonsberg had asked Boris Johnson whether we would be able to travel this summer, and Boris Johnson didn't answer the question. I thought that was quite entertaining. The point there from Vallance, though, very, very important, which is to say that because this mutation is also evolving independently in this country, we really do need to get rates of transmission down, because the more transmission you have, the more mutations you have, the more likely it is that our vaccine program will be undermined. Again, I should stress, it's not going to make the AstraZeneca vaccine completely useless, but it is going to mean that at least it's not really going to stop transmission, which is going to be very, very important. We're going to go on to our next story. The ongoing Saudi war against Yemen has resulted in what is perhaps the biggest humanitarian crisis on earth right now. The Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project have reported that 100,000 people have died as a result of the war, which includes more than 12,000 civilians killed in attacks directly targeting them. So that's a war crime if you directly target civilians in a war. Now, what's more, according to Save the Children, the blockade imposed by the Saudis and their partners is the leading cause of a humanitarian crisis that has claimed more than 85,000 infant lives. Now, the Saudi war is only possible because of support from the US and UK governments, which meant this announcement from Joe Biden was a relief to many.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
So that was one of Joe Biden's first acts as president, to halt the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia if they will be used for offensive operations. However, the British government is not following the US in suspending arms exports. This was James Cleverly, Minister for the Middle East and North Africa, in the Commons on Monday.
I note the US decision to pause its arms exports whilst it reviews its policy towards Yemen, and I can reassure the House that the government takes its own export responsibilities extremely seriously and assesses all export licences in accordance with strict licensing criteria.
So the argument there is that Britain doesn't need to suspend arms sales because we already have strict licensing criteria on exports. I'll be asking my guest, David Waring, what relationship that statement has to reality. I wanted to start by getting you to talk about the significance of that announcement from Joe Biden specifically. So he's pledged to end support for offensive operations and related arms sales. A cynic might say, well, the Saudis will just say these are defensive operations and then the Americans will sell them arms anyway. How seriously should we take the commitment from him? Is this a big deal or is this just rhetoric?
People have focused on that choice of words, offensive operations. And as you rightly say, Saudis will say, as everyone does when they're in a war, well, we're doing all of this from the point of view of self-defense. But if you look at that choice of words within the context of the wider announcement, it becomes quite clear that Biden wants this war over. He's called for the UN to call for a ceasefire. And actually, the US's role up till now on the Security Council has been to give diplomatic cover to the Saudis. Now he wants the UN Security Council to call for a ceasefire. He's appointed an envoy to the conflict whose job is going to be to bring the parties together and end the war. He clearly wants this over. So it's not a kind of, you know, here's a clever formulation of words that I can use so we can carry on business as usual while it looks like I've honoured my promises. He does seem actually to be following through. And it's really significant because, as you indicated in the intro to this piece, the British and the Americans sustained the Saudi bombing campaign. That's a really important thing that I always try and drive home in these interviews because I don't think there's sufficient understanding about that. It's not the case that people have just been, that the British have just, and the Americans have just sold these arms years ago and then the Saudis are using them now. There's ongoing operational support that the British and the Americans have been providing, which has literally kept the Saudi jets in the sky, which if you remove that support, those Saudi jets don't fly anymore. And the Saudis' entire war has been based around the exertion of aerial power. So for the Americans to literally pull the plug on offensive operations, it's a really, really important thing. I mean, the Americans, the Saudis depend on the Americans for their survival, effectively. I'm talking about the regime rather than the population. So, you know, when your superpower patron tells you it's over, then it is kind of over more.
Is it over even if the UK don't follow suit? I mean, obviously, you know, we live in Britain, so we should be lobbying our government to follow Joe Biden in this pledge. Yeah. But is it almost irrelevant what the British do here? Are the Saudis now screwed because of Joe Biden's decision?
There's a mismatch between the power of the British versus the Americans. And the Americans are much more powerful. Now, if it had been the other way around, let's say Labour had been elected in 2017 or 2019, and Labour had pulled the plug on its portion of support for the portion of the Saudi Air Force that's British supplied, that would have really impeded the Saudi campaign. If it had been Trump, which it was in both those elections, Trump as president would probably have carried it on, but it would have made it much harder because the British component of the Saudi Air Force is really, really significant. It's about half of the jets that are in operation over Yemen. So you've impeded the war, but you've impeded the Saudis' effort. The British supply jets are really important within their war effort. But with the Americans, it's different, not just because the Americans supply the other half, but because this is a superpower, right? It's ultimately the Americans that the Saudis are dependent on. If the Americans clip their fingers, the Saudis have to fall in line. And from the British point of view, that means that it looks like the Saudis, certainly offensive operations are going to be over, and it doesn't sound as though, you know, defensive is going to be defined in such a way as to allow them to carry on substantively. So the Saudis' war is going to be significantly wound down, leaving Britain with not much of a war to carry on fueling, carry on supporting. So it's kind of a fait accompli from the point of view of, you know, where the British are. And I think one of the reasons that they're refusing to say, oh, yeah, okay, we're going to do the same as Joe Biden, is they would effectively be accepting that what they've denied all along, that their arms sales are fueling the conflict, is in fact true. The last thing they'd want to do is corroborate what Joe Biden has just said about the role of the British and the Americans.
That's interesting. So, because obviously I was thinking, is this because they're making so much money from this? Obviously, 40%, I think, of the volume of UK arms exports between 2010 and 2019 have been to Saudi Arabia. So I was thinking potentially this is just the money is too big. That's why they're they're not following Joe Biden. But I think that's a really strong argument, actually, you make there, that for them to say, oh, Trump's gone, now we'll withdraw, is to suggest that their policy was actually never based on, well, we all know it was never based on human rights, but it's an admission that their policy was never based on human rights. It was just they'll do whatever completely with no, you know, attention to what is what right and wrong. They'll just go along with whoever happens to be US president.
And remember, the British government could be back in court on this in the not too distant future. So there's been two court cases, one in the High Court, one in the Court of Appeal. In the High Court case, so this is brought by a campaign against arms trade, who have done, within British civil society, the best work on Yemen. And what the case is all about is basically saying the arms controls that Britain has, which the government is always saying are really robust and tight and all the rest of it, completely disproved by the Yemen case. The arms controls say you cannot sell arms to a country if there's a clear risk that the arms may be used, not will, may be used in serious violation of international law, which, of course, they have been routinely for 5 years. And the government somehow successfully argued that it reached a conclusion that that risk didn't exist through a rational and defensible process. It successfully argued that to the High Court, God knows how. I think partly to do with judges not wanting to second-guess governments on national security. But Campaign Against Arms Trade appealed it. The appeal court struck it down and basically said to the government, you haven't approached this correctly. You need to suspend the approval of licenses. So the government said, OK, we'll suspend them and we'll look into it properly, which, of course, they didn't. They looked into it and came back and said, oh, we've looked into it and it's just a few isolated incidents. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the UN all say it's widespread and systematic attacks on civilian targets. British government said it's isolated incidents, and they carried on, or they resumed giving approval for licenses for arms exports. Campaign Against Arms Trade are appealing against that. Now, if the next court case, Campaign Against Arms Trade and their lawyers are going to be able to point to the Americans and say, look, the Americans, the other side of this, the other partner of the Saudis, have accepted that they've been sustaining this bombing. And Biden said out loud, you know, in that speech and many times on the campaign trail, that what the Americans were doing was unconscionable. So the British can't, for that legal reason, accept what Biden says. So they have to say, oh, well, he makes US policy, we make ours. The reality is, though, that this war is, you know, the plug has been pulled. I very much doubt that serious Saudi operations are going to carry on past this point. So the British won't have a war to support, but they're in a very awkward and embarrassing position.
And finally, I know this is a big question, so try and keep it brief, even though it's a big question. This has been, as we both said, one of the biggest humanitarian crises of the past 5 or 6 years on Earth. This news from Joe Biden, which means that the Saudis will have to some degree, stop offensive operations. What is now the near future looking like for the people of Yemen? Is peace on the horizon? What happens now?
So the Saudis are the biggest killers in the war, and they've been taken out of the game to a significant degree. So that saves lives instantly. Just as if Labour had won in 2017 or 2019, it would have saved lives instantly. The humanitarian crisis is largely the product of the blockade that the Saudis and the UAE have imposed. I mean, if that ends, Yemen is of a much better chance in humanitarian terms. It all then comes down to dialogue. Civil wars, especially in the Middle East, are often sustained and prolonged by outside interference. The domestic parties don't have the incentive to make peace with each other because they've got regional powers backing them and international powers piling in as well. Now, the Saudis being the biggest killer in the conflict, having that support withdrawn potentially could start a process of de-escalation where other parties start pulling out, external parties, particularly Iran, potentially pull out their support as well. Domestic parties have more incentive to make peace. We knew all this 5 years ago. There was never going to be a military solution to this conflict. It had to be about a national dialogue between the communities in Yemen. Hopefully that will now take place. We'll see the conflict de-escalating and we'll find some kind of, Yemen's still going to be a disaster area, but the worst of it could be over and we could be on a better path from here, hopefully.
David Waring, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Not at all. Thank you.
Since
Keir Starmer became Labour leader, suspensions from the party have accelerated apace. Many of these, justly or unjustly, involve accusations related to anti-Semitism, which means there has been a great deal of anticipation about the creation of an independent complaints procedure for anti-Semitism due to come into being later this year. Now, many suspect it will be this complaints process which will ultimately decide the future of Starmer's predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn. Now, as part of the process of putting together this new system, an advisory board has been put together, and its membership has caused quite a bit of consternation among the Labour left. We think this was announced today because it just appeared on the Labour Party website. There was no press release. The members of the board are David Evans, General Secretary of the Labour Party. He's obviously the person who made the decision to suspend Jeremy Corbyn in the first place. Adrian Cohen is a trustee of the Jewish Leadership Council. He's also a co-chair of Labour Friends of Israel. Natasha Engel, trustee of Anti-Semitism Policy Trust, is a former MP. Mark Gardner, CEO of the Community Security Trust. They put out that document, Engines of Hate, which labelled quite a lot of sort of Corbyn-supporting Twitter accounts anti-Semitic. Marie van der Zaal, president of the Board of Deputies. You probably know a lot about the Board of Deputies. They are a legitimate representative of Jewish organisations in the UK. They also this week tweeted opposition to the International Criminal Court decision that it had jurisdiction in Palestinian territories. So it also is, you know, as well as being a representative body, it has politics. Dame Margaret Hodge obviously called Jeremy Corbyn an effing anti-Semite, which is also lied about me on social media. Baroness Doreen Lawrence of Clarendon and Baroness Jan Royale of Blaisdon. She wrote the document into alleged anti-Semitism at the Oxford Labour Club. Now, to discuss these appointments, I'm delighted to be joined by Rivka Brown, who, as of this week, is a commissioning editor and reporter at Novara Media. Rivka is also editor of the Jewish media platform Vashti. Thank you for coming on the show tonight.
Thanks, Michael.
Could I get you to talk me through the makeup of this advisory board? Now, many of those names will be familiar to people who followed the row about Labour and anti-Semitism over the past 5 years, and many of them won't be. So on the whole, what does it tell us about the process that these are the people who the party has picked?
Sure. So I think there are no real surprises on this list other than perhaps Baroness Lawrence, which we can talk about later. But I think, you know, those members of the board that I am familiar with, which is the kind of the rest of them, really, I think what characterizes them above all is that they are not anti-racists. You know, these include people like Marie van der Zeel, who wouldn't condemn Trump's racism, the Jewish Leadership Council, whose members believe that the concept of Islamophobia is moronic, and whose members, including the millionaire property tycoon Leo Noe, donate to settlements in Hebron. These are not people that I trust with an anti-racism agenda. These are people who have expressed a very specific and particular interest in anti-Semitism in the Labour Party during the Corbyn years, but don't seem to have broader than that, anti-racist principles, which I would expect of such a board. I think really what this tells us, their kind of limited experience in anti-racism, is that they actually have quite a poor understanding of anti-Semitism. You know, many of these people are people who claim, for example, that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic, something that we know to be false, and who claim that only Jewish people should be able to determine their own oppression, often citing the McPherson principle wrongly. Ironically, obviously, this principle originated in the investigation into Baroness Lawrence's son's murder. So, you know, these are not people who I think are very familiar with what anti-racism means, even really what anti-Semitism means. And so, you know, I don't really trust to give good advice to the leader of the Labour Party. I think they've been brought in as allies of Keir Starmer, as yes men, really. I think, you know, in some ways it's quite incredible. It's hard to get a group of Jewish people in a room who will all agree with each other. But somehow, you know, Keir Starmer has managed to do just that. These are not people who really disagree about the nature and the causes of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and in fact have quite a kind of specific attribution of that problem to the kind of Corbynite left. And so I don't think there are going to be very many interesting insights or kind of much interesting advice to come out of this board.
And let's talk a little bit about who's been excluded as well. So
I mean, I don't know everyone who was nominated to this board, but one thing we do know is that John McDonnell nominated Anthony Lerman, who's former director of the Institute of Jewish Policy Research, Brian Clark, an Oxford professor and founding member of Jewish Forum for Justice and Human Rights, and Rabbi Danny Rich, who until last year was senior rabbi and chief executive of Liberal Judaism in the UK. Now, at least the first two of those I know were people who were quite prominent voices critical of the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism, because they thought it limited people's ability to advocate for Palestinian rights. I'm sure the mainstream media sort of analysis of this and from Labour MPs will be, look, what did you want? Did you want cranks on this panel? These are the people who are the legitimate representatives of British Judaism. You're just suggesting people, you know, talking to the left who are, you know, not really part of that community. They're just apologists for Jeremy Corbyn anyway. What are you complaining about?
Right.
How would you respond to that?
What I would say is that these organizations have been on a PR campaign to brand themselves as the representative voices of British Jewry. I mean, that's literally the Board of Deputies slogan. Ironically, the very existence of the Jewish Leadership Council is proof that that's not true. The JLC split off from the Board of Deputies when a number of their kind of big benefactors realized that they couldn't use their money to just influence the board. So you know, that split is evidence that the board doesn't represent British Jewry, and it certainly doesn't represent, in fact, none of these organizations really represent the over half of British Jews who are either secular, so not affiliated to a synagogue or wouldn't identify with any of those communal bodies, or ultra-Orthodox. And that's probably because a lot of those groups, particularly and including in the ultra-Orthodox community, supported and continue to support Jeremy Corbyn. You know, there was a letter in 2018 at the height of the anti-Semitism crisis signed by, I think, around 30 ultra-Orthodox rabbis, you know, expressing their support for Jeremy Corbyn. And those voices are often marginalized in the debate around anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, despite the fact that ultra-Orthodox Jews in the UK, in the US, are often at the receiving end of the most acute anti-Semitic violence. You know, there was a stabbing in Stamford Hill just around the corner from where I grew up of an ultra-Orthodox man just last summer. So, you know, it's profoundly painful and ironic, but in many ways unsurprising that a huge proportion, perhaps even the majority of British Jews in this country, are not represented by any of those bodies. What I would say also is that the way that this board has been selected doesn't even represent the Labour Party itself, doesn't even represent the PLP. You know, speaking today to a number of left-wing Jewish MPs, none were consulted, including Charlotte Nichols, who is the Shadow Equalities Minister, and you know, this is therefore very much in her remit, and it's therefore it's completely patent that, you know, the voices of left-wing Jews outside the party, within the party, were completely silenced on this issue. There was no consultation of the kind of PLP. That, you know, Charlotte and colleagues found out about this these appointments in the same way that I did, you know, on social media, in the announcements. And, you know, there's even been reports that the Board of Deputies and the Jewish Labour Movement had veto over who was nominated. You know, this was a completely undemocratic process, I'm sorry, in a manner that's kind of appears to be quite characteristic of particularly David Evans' way of managing the party.
I mean, that's really interesting that Jewish members of the PLP weren't consulted. I also know that the NEC weren't consulted about this. So the people who make up this board seems to have been a unilateral decision by David Evans, the general secretary. I'm told that, in fact, NEC members had previously asked, you know, for sight of who was being considered for the panel, and that was refused. So this doesn't seem like a decision which has involved many different opinions and stances and perspectives from within the Labour Party. I want to go to sort of some general issues in the Labour Party. I want to bring in Aaron for this one as well, because we know now that the 50 chairs or over 50 chairs and secretaries who were suspended for allowing motions relating to Corbyn losing the Labour whip. There's been some developments in that case, which we talked about before on this show. Now, apparently the legal advice to the party is that they should all be reinstated. Some already have, but many are still waiting for the information. So on learning this, I reached out to Darren McLaughlin, who you might have seen previously on Tisky. He was a co-secretary in Bristol. He had been suspended again for the same reason as everyone else, because they debated a motion which wasn't necessarily even about Corbyn, but related to the issue. He was going to be a candidate, but that seat has now been passed on to someone else, or it's about to be selected for someone else, which is why he thinks potentially there is a delay before letting him back in. Aaron, I want to throw to you on where you think this is heading.
Yeah, Bristol's a really interesting microcosm because, of course, it's one of the largest CLPs in the country, constituency Labour parties in the country. I think actually it's really emblematic of the direction of the Labour Party under Keir Starmer. So you had one of these Metro Mayor nominations for the southwest of England. It's not for Bristol. That's obviously Marvin Rees. And the person who won that was a former Labour MP, a former Blairite, surprise, surprise. But he didn't actually win the most votes in the nomination process. So it was still chosen by people who weren't the members. I thought the whole point of a nomination, democratic nomination process, was that the person with the most votes wins, but apparently not. At the same time, it's not just Darren. There have been a number of other people as well, Michael, on the left, who were looking to contest council seats. They thought they would be Labour councillors after May, and there's basically been a bureaucratic manoeuvre to get rid of them. And I think when you look at Bristol, you know, we have people saying the future of the Labour Party is Zara Sultana or, you know, any young left-wing MP, Sam Tarry. That's not true. I think that the future of the Labour Party right now is what we're seeing in Bristol, which is the imposition effectively of a failed Blairite MP as the candidate for the mayor of the Southwest, and the removal of young, charismatic people who would like to be local representatives. So one happens to be a BAME man and another is a woman. And these are the kinds of people that Labour repeatedly says they want to elevate as public representatives, whose votes, by the way, as general demographics, they depend upon. And yet when push comes to shove, they aren't really serious about it.
Rivka, I want to go for you for your final thoughts on what happens next. I know you've been sort of following the internal disputes within the Labour Party. Does this advisory board, maybe we shouldn't overstate how significant it's going to be, but is what we've seen so far suggestive of a future purge of Labour left members? Or do you think that this might all be worrying, but not necessarily that, let's say, pivotal in the future of the Labour left?
First of all, I would say that this is, you know, it isn't significant necessarily in itself, but it is a turning point in which a number of actors who've been trying to kind of enforce their authority on the Labour Party, you know, the Board of Deputies 10 pledges, which they, you know, kind of encouraged Labour leadership candidates to sign up for, included the board having oversight of the disciplinary process, which, I mean, is illegal or would have been illegal. You know, this does represent a kind of dovetailing of some of those kind of establishment Jewish groups and the Labour Party. So I think it is a concerning development. I think it will also, I mean, it kind of goes to what Aaron was saying. It does mark a kind of further a furthering of this trend that we've seen of Jews being used as a battering ram against the left. You know, this will, the advice of this board will be used to make more and more kind of tenuous suspensions and expulsions. You know, still supporting Jeremy Corbyn, you're an anti-Semite. Still, you know, calling for, you know, no confidence in David Evans, you're an anti-Semite. Want to hold a pro-Palestine solidarity event, anti-Semite. And, you know, to me, this does kind of give credibility to that kind of political football, as it were. But I think, you know, in terms of what's going to happen to left-wing Jews in the Labour Party, I think this is already a trend that has kind of is well in train. You know, Jewish people, like a lot of left-wing Jews, I should say, like a lot of left-wing people, have begun to leave the Labour Party in order to kind of throw themselves into social movements. And in the case of British Jews, that's Na'amod, that's Jewish Solidarity Action, that's, you know, Judas, and hope to be kind of modelling the anti-racism that we want to see from the Labour Party from without, rather than attempting to kind of fight a losing battle from within.
Rivka Brown, thank you so much for joining us this evening. And I'm sure we'll be speaking a lot more on Tisky Sour in the future.
I hope so, Michael. See you soon.
Let's go straight on to another story about the Labour Party. 18 Labour peers have defied the party whip to vote in favour of reinserting an amendment to the Spy Cops Bill that would ban the authorisation of rape, torture and murder by public bodies for undercover agents. Now, the vote took place on Tuesday in a Lords debate on the covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill, which gives law enforcement agents immunity when breaking the law while working undercover. Now, we've talked about this bill before. There are arguments for it. In principle, undercover agents will sometimes have to break the law. So, for example, by joining a prescribed organization, that in itself is illegal. So it would make sense to say, well, if you were joining a prescribed organization so as to undermine their activities, think of a far-right organization, then That should be fine. The problem with the bill, though, is that it has no limits on what laws undercover agents are able to break. That's why former Shadow Attorney General Shami Chakrabarty tabled an amendment which would rule out legalising agents to commit the most serious crimes, including rape and torture.
My Lords, the government's rebuttal is, I'm afraid, both circular and hollow. It argues that the grave offences in this amendment would provide a deadly checklist against which suspected undercover agents might be tested, but it also argues that the convention rights already provide these express prohibitions. My Lords, this amendment might either be dangerous or superfluous, but it surely cannot be both. So which is it? In the past, government lawyers have argued that the convention rights do not bind undercover agents of the state. And only recently, in the very litigation which provoked this bill, they have argued that agents are not precluded from committing murder. My Lords, what would your Lordship's House say if this kind of criminal immunity, without detailed limitation for even grave offences, were being passed in Russia, China, or anywhere other than here? My Lords, what indeed would the government say? So as a matter of conscience, and if only to record our grave concerns for the benefit of the litigators and senior jurists who will inevitably pick up the stitches that legislators have dropped, I wish to test the opinion of your Lordship's House and beg to move.
Really well put, very important argument there by Shami Chakrabarty. The defence by the government of not having specific legislation to exclude this being used to justify rape or murder or any other heinous crimes is because they say this will mean that if someone in a prescribed group or a drug trafficking group or whatever, if they want to get someone to prove they are not an agent of the state, then they will just make them, they'll just go through the checklist of things that you're not allowed to do as an agent. She's saying that doesn't work because the government are also arguing we don't need to specifically legislate for murder, rape, etc., because that's made impossible because of the Human Rights Act or the European Courts of Justice. So it all falls down. The argument I think the Labour Party were kind of putting forward to say that they're going to abstain is that this had already ping-ponged between the Commons and the Lords and the Commons and the Lords. But Shami Chakrabarty made the important point that this was not in the Conservatives' manifesto. So there is a convention that the Lords won't block anything which was in a party manifesto because that would be anti-democratic. But Shami Chakrabarty saying this wasn't in the manifesto. So it is well within our rights as the House of Lords to block this legislation, which we think will be terrible for human rights. Now, it didn't pass. The amendment didn't pass. Sorry, the law has. It will almost certainly go into law without that amendment. Labour whipped to abstain. But the rebels weren't only confined to the Labour left. There were 18 Labour Lords who rebelled. They included Andrew Adonis, who's a former minister under Blair, and Stuart Wood, who is a former advisor to Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband. Aaron, I want your take on this. I mean, it's quite interesting, actually, that the rebellion did include people who we would, you know, normally think to be quite amenable to Keir Starmer. Andrew Adonis is, I mean, I might assume he was a Starmerite, but he was willing to break the whip on this occasion.
I think Andrew Adonis, in more ways than one, Michael, is quite, you know, to use a Latin term, sui generis. He's quite unique. You know, I think he would like Labour to rejoin, you know, campaign to rejoin the European Union in 2024. I think he's clearly a liberal. I mean, you can say he's got bad politics from any which way, but I think when it comes to civil liberties, he's relatively consistent. I mean, his political trajectory before Labour was from, you know, the Social Democratic Party and the Liberal Democrats. So I believe I think the only position he's actually ever been elected to, I believe he was either a Lib Dem councillor or he ran for Lib Dem councillor and didn't win. That doesn't matter. It's by the by. It's important to say that, though, because you say former cabinet minister, of course, he was unelected. He was also, I believe, the first head of the Downing Street policy unit under Tony Blair. That was definitely a role he had. So very much within the kind of the Blairite penumbra of interests and people and personalities, for sure, but very much a liberal. Stuart Wood, similarly, soft left. Yes. I mean, you know, 18, Michael, 18. It should be a lot more than that. Let's be honest. I think this law and Labour's positioning on it, frankly, is a moral nadir. I think it's a moral nadir, because you are genuflecting to, I think, a grotesque proposal for what? You know, Keir Starmer's doing this because he has this prestige, this idea of Tory voters and the Red Wall who he has to win. He's completely selling out any moral basis he might have sort of laid his integrity upon. What for? Latest polling shows that Labour are winning 4% of 2019 Tory voters, but they're giving 2% back. So there's a net 2% gain amongst these people. And he's making such immense personal, political, and I think ultimately professional sacrifice. I think it completely undermines his credibility as the next prime minister when he's behaving like this. For what? It's having no electoral payoff. So I think it really is a nadir for both Keir Starmer and for the Labour Party. We say it repeatedly on this show, but look, this is politics. If you looked at the opinion polls and Labour were leading and Labour were gaining 2019 Tory voters, it's understandable. It's explicable. It's in a way excusable by appealing to a language of political expediency. However, it's not working. So on any, you know, set of terms you wish to kind of examine it, it's a failure. And I think really people look back on this as the low point of all low points under Keir Starmer's leadership. I think that's very possible, just because it's just a reprehensible law.
It's similar to the Yemen situation, because it's one where we find ourselves to the right of the American establishment. So Joe Biden now is saying that America is not going to support offensive operations for the Saudis, Britain to the right of that. And in this case, even in American law, undercover agents are precluded from committing murder or rape. And Britain, for some reason, is not willing to put those clauses into this particular law. We're going to wrap up there. Aaron Bastani, it has been a pleasure as always.
My pleasure, Michael.
Always lovely to speak to you on a Wednesday evening. Thank you for everyone for your super chats tonight. If you want to support us directly, then you can go to navarromedia.com/support. We'll be back on Friday at 7 p.m. So make sure to hit subscribe. For now, you've been watching Tisky Sour on Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarromedia.com/support.